Dr. Michael is a Herschel and a Ruth Seder Professor in the Department of Biomedical Engineering, and also he's also the director of the Center for Imaging Science at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Miller is an internationally recognized leader and a pioneer in many major areas of medical imaging, including imaging understanding, pattern theory, computer vision, computational anatomy, and computational neuroscience. He has been received numerous prestigious awards for his work, including the recent one, which he received in 2003. The award name, I thought is very good, it's called the International Man of the Year, which he received from the International Biogeographical Center in Cambridge, England. So Dr. Miller, without further ado, I give you Dr. Miller.
So you lovely Canadians have a wonderful tradition of medical imaging. Certainly I started coming to McGill and then Calgary and then Vancouver. And of course, Keith Worsley was always here and I miss him very much. Keith Worsley is a great man. And let me honor him through this talk today. He always appreciated what we were doing. Okay, I'm gonna talk about diffeomorphic shape momentum, computational anatomy, and neuroinformatics. So we'd like to do neuroinformatics at 1 millimeter scale. We'd essentially like to do Google Maps, but in brains. To do that, we can't use rigid motions and scales, similitudes. We have to go to essentially the infinite dimensional analog of that, which are the diffeomorphisms, so that we can push or pull information that we might have on subcortical and cortical structures, stereotactic, Broadman's maps, white matter tracts, fMRI bold response, spectroscopy. So the tools that we've developed over the last 15 years essentially are to generalize the rigid motions to this infinite dimensional group called diffeomorphisms. It allows us to accommodate human variability and biological shape, and that turns out to have a beautiful connection to geometric mechanics and angular momentum, essentially the infinite dimensional analog of angular momentum. We call it diffeomorphic momentum, and I'll show examples of that in medical imaging. So computational anatomy models human anatomy as an orbit of exemplars under the diffeomorphism group. Populations are studied via templates with statistics encoded in template coordinates. Diffeomorphic correspondences are used to carry the information from population coordinate systems to template coordinates. We generate the diffeomorphism group as solutions of the ordinary differential equations, essentially the Euler-Lagrange equations. We use both. We compute on grids with the Eulerian, so we look at the flow of the inverse. We have to force this to be a smooth flow of the inverse, and of course we use Lagrangian coordinates, phi dot equals v of phi. So we imagine that the brain is made up of a collection of particles, essentially a continuum of particles, and these particles move under flows. We're going to force these flows to be smooth flows, essentially to be flows of diffeomorphisms. Homeomorphisms with differentiability, so we can compute arc length and surface area. So for that, we have to make we have to smooth the vector fields. If you look at the equation phi dot equals v of phi, the vector fields are not finite dimensional. For example, if you were looking at the translation, then v, the vector field at every position on the lattice would be the same vector, so it would be 3 degrees of freedom in R3. If you were looking at rotation, it would be 6 degrees of freedom with translation, so 3 for rotation and 3 for scale. But here the vector fields are essentially, they're in a Hilbert space, which is an infinite dimensional object. As I said, we're gonna work with both the Lagrangian and the Eulerian, and D is gonna stand for the Jacobian matrix. So we're gonna, of course, need spatial smoothness on the inverse in order to compute the Jacobian. We do that by essentially requiring the vector fields to be spatially smooth. So we're going to imagine that the vector fields that carry through a smooth flow one set of coordinates into another corresponds to a norm. It's going to be a Sobolev norm corresponding to a reproducible kernel Hilbert space. So we're going to force that essentially, if you look at derivatives of the vector fields at any point of time in space, then that's going to have finite norm. Then if you look at that integral over dt, That's going to be the essentially the equation that we're going to use to compute shortest paths or geodesic connections from one anatomical coordinate system to another. Now, the way that the anatomies enter into it is we essentially look at flows. So we start at time zero, that's the identity, and then we flow the particles. And we imagine that the flow carries the anatomy. So I'll use the abstract symbol here called I. You can think of this as an image, but this could be any submanifold of R3. So we have all the theory now and the codes for any submanifold of R3, points, curves, surfaces, and subvolumes, as well as vectors and matrices. So think of I abstractly. And then you have some group action that tells you how you carry the image. So if it was a point, you would just take phi and move it to phi of x. If it was a function, like a scalar image, then it would be phi acting on the right through its inverse. So it would be I composed with phi inverse. For vectors and matrices, we have actions as well. So then the basic variational problem becomes search over the space of flows, phi, minimizing a quantity like this subject to carrying the image, which we might think of as the template, onto the target called I prime, and we want to find the minimum to that to problems of that kind. Now, in order to enforce smoothness, as I said, we think of V as corresponding to a Sobolev space that essentially controls derivatives, and it corresponds to which dominates. It gives us a reproducing kernel Hilbert space, so there'll be a kernel in the space. We represent the derivatives through an operator A, so you can think of A as something like the Laplacian to some power. AVT is then forced when integrated against V to be finite. The way to think about why this is essentially controlling smoothness spatially is if you were to take the square root of A and move it over to V, then you'd essentially say if, for example, you had two derivatives in A, then it would be making a statement that one derivative of V had finite L2 norm, which of course bounds the space of V's. It's a constraint on V's. Turns out that if you want to solve problems like this and stay in the space of flows, you need in R3 essentially Laplacian to the 2 to the p power, where p is greater than or equal to 1.5. In R2, you need less. You need about p equal 1. Okay, so this is the setup for the variational problems that we're going to solve. And now I'm going to make the connection to momentum. To essentially shape momentum, the generalization of angular momentum and rigid motion momentum. So if we now think of AVT, let's just think of it for now as a function. In fact, it's a one form that works on vector fields. So the vector fields are smoother in general than the momentum, as you can see, because if A is a bunch of derivatives, AVT may be a measure or may be worse than measures. For landmark matching, for example, it's atomic and it's a bunch of delta Diracs that sit on the landmarks. But let's think of AVT, the momentum, MT, as a smooth function for now. If, for various problems, if we impose smoothness, then we can force the momentum to be smooth. I'll call that MT. Then we have essentially a force equation that corresponds to these geodesics, which essentially is the derivative in time of the momentum that tells you how these flows have to occur. And the force equation essentially looks like, well, you have that the derivative in time of the momentum at all times t connecting the template to the target, so you have an endpoint condition in that kind of a problem, is balanced by a series of internal forces. These internal forces correspond to the fact that the medium is squishy, so we're not in the rigid body setting, and A, the differential operator, is essentially taking derivatives, so you're paying penalties there. So we have a Jacobian matrix on VT with a transpose. So the derivative of MT is balanced by the negative of all of this. We have a divergence of VT with the momentum, and we have essentially a Jacobian on MT with VT. This is the analogous force equation that you have in rigid body or in the finite dimensional Lie groups for geodesics connecting one element to the other. Now, what's nice about this, why we study equations like this, of course, is this means something about momentum, a conservation law that's associated with momentum. If we're satisfying this, then it turns out that there's a conservation principle that M must satisfy. So it's very much the idea that if you specify the momentum at time zero, so if you look at this equation and you specify the momentum at time zero, then this equation tells you how the entire flow occurs. Much like when you're putting on the green, if there's no wind and the green doesn't change, then your initial putt completely determines the path and the hole that you're gonna hit. So what the momentum conservation looks like is essentially an equation like this. So the way you think of conservation here is you interpret the momentum as acting on a smooth function or a smooth vector field, and then you look at the inner product at any point in time, t, so that, you know, if W is a smooth vector field and it's the space of smooth vector fields are rich enough, then this, of course, completely determines the momentum at every point in time if you have an equation like this. So it says that the derivative in time of the inner product of the momentum with the Jacobian on the map phi acting on W pulled back under phi t inverse is zero. Now, the reason why it's complicated like this is because of the Eulerian Lagrangian setup. So if you have a smooth vector field at time t, so just imagine W is at time t. If you want to understand the property of the momentum, well, you go to a particle at time t, you pull it back under phi inverse, you look at W on it, then you move it under the Jacobian of the map, and then that integrated against the momentum is essentially a constant over time t, because this momentum is essentially the Eulerian momentum. It's the particles are sitting there and the particles are passing through you. Now, what's great about this, of course, is that now we know we can write an equation down for the momentum at any time t along the path is totally encoded by the momentum at time zero, just like when you shoot the arrow with no wind, or if you put the ball with no wind. You just have to specify the way you aim initially, and then it determines the complete path. Let me give you an example showing you how we use it. Well, we can use this notion to steer one anatomy onto another. Well, this is, of course, a very simple anatomy, two simple blobs. Let's imagine that the template is smooth, so that's going to give us a condition on the momentum being smooth. Then, essentially, the way we solve the steering problem is we look at the target image looked at under the mapping at time one. We imagine that the target image is in the orbit of the template I under all flows indexed at one. Here, the group action is I composed with phi inverse. We minimize this quantity subject to this running cost. The running cost gives us smooth flows, so we're guaranteed to get diffeomorphic change of the template at all t. Then the conservation law looks like this. M, the momentum at every point t, is specified by m at zero. And in this case, m at zero is given by this equation. It involves I prime, the target image, under the flow from t to one, subtracted from the template image, under the inverse at t. That gives you a difference. You weight it by essentially the Jacobian, the determinant of the Jacobian of the map, and it's always pointing in the direction normal to the level lines of the template being carried. So there's a very important property comes out of the conservation law. So it's always, for dense image matching, it's always normal to the level line. So if you want to know what the initial momentum is to carry the template onto the target, m0, you just put 0 here. So you get it, it points in the direction of the gradient of the image, so it's normal to the level lines. It's weighted by the change in density, phi, of the mapping, and it's I prime composed with phi at time one minus I. So you can think of our codes, our geodesic codes, as basically like shooting an arrow. We choose m0, we shoot the arrow, it's far from the target, it gives us a difference at time one for these terms. We change m0, we shoot again, gives us a difference, we keep changing until the template put through the mapping is very close to the target. Okay, now why is the momentum important? Well, the momentum's important for biological shape, just like the angular momentum is important for rigid motion. It's a huge data reduction. So you know if you have a billiard ball or some complicated object with a moment of inertia, every particle is moving with a different velocity, yet it has a single number called an angular momentum. The same is true in biological shape. The vector fields can be horribly complex, but the momentum representation is very simple. So here's, for example, shooting this object onto this. Here's the vector field that corresponds to it at time zero. So if you were to essentially push all the particles at time zero under this vector field and satisfy the conservation law, which would mean you're on a geodesic of this flow, then that would match it to that target. Here's what the momentum looks like. It's normal to the level line, so it's zero at all the constants. So that's a huge data reduction, and it's essentially on the boundary of the object. So it's a very minimal description of biological shape, even though we're in the infinite dimensional setting here. So we have many methods of steering anatomical configurations one onto the other. We call these codes large deformation diffeomorphic metric mapping. We can steer point sets to point sets, landmarks, curves, and surfaces, so submanifolds of R3, dense images, vectors, very important in DTI, diffusion imaging, tensors. As well, we have a whole series of technologies like this for time series, longitudinal atrophy and growth. Now, this code is being essentially delivered through a service model, so we have a large super grid computer. Currently, in January, we were doing about 1,300 maps a month. People essentially download. There's been about 5,000 registered users on this GUI. It's called MRI Studio. Through the GUI, you can essentially submit jobs. They run these codes, and they allow you to build these diffeomorphic correspondences for your particular study that you're interested in. Now, we're here at this wonderful workshop. I'm so glad I was invited. Thank you, John, for inviting me, and thank you, Adrian. I really appreciate it. This is a long line of beautiful workshops. I wanted to do two or three more slides of a little bit of mathematics, just because it's appropriate. I wanted to just tell you what the connection is to geometric mechanics. As I've been alluding, this diffeomorphism group is almost a Lie group. It's essentially the infinite dimensional analog of the finite dimensional Lie groups that we use for rigid motion and affine motion. The Lie bracket has the Jacobian matrix in it. So it's not quite the Lie group in the sense that it's not closed under the Lie bracket, but it has everything else. Okay, so I'm gonna just show you what I mean by that in the context of rigid motion very simply. So for diffeomorphic shape, essentially the phi dot equals V composed with phi. The Lagrangian is right invariant, and I'm gonna tell you in a moment why. So phi dot composed with phi inverse. This is in the Lie algebra essentially, and then we have a norm on the Lie algebra. That's what the space V is, and it, corresponding to that differential operator is a reproducing kernel K. It's gonna show up in the equation. And that norm basically looks like this. VT transpose, if these are vector fields in R3, they're integrated over X, so unlike the matrices, you have to do an integral over X. And then it's AVT, and I was calling this M of T. Now the Hamiltonian in this setup, if you're a Hamiltonian person and you wanna interpret this AVT, which I call the Eulerian momentum, you would use conjugate variables, so you would use phi, the generalized coordinates, you would use P, well, I don't know, you guys sometimes use P and Q, but P for the conjugate momentum or the canonical momentum, and the way you would get H of phi of P from the Lagrangian is you'd essentially look at an equation in phi, phi dot, and P. I wrote it here for you. P star phi dot. So P star is, this canonical momentum is like a one form that acts on phi dot, so it's dual to phi dot. It's the canonical momentum. The integral of that minus the Lagrangian, and you would go from three variables, P, phi, phi dot, down to two variables by moving the phi dot. You take the sup over that, and then you'd get a Hamiltonian, and if you wanted to build a force equation, you'd look at the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to phi, and that would give you the force equation in mechanics. Now, for rigid bodies, people generally use phi acting on the left, phi dot equals phi omega. Let's think of omega now, instead of being a 3x1 vector field, it's a 3x3 skew symmetric matrix, but it really is only determined by 3 degrees of freedom. So there's a little omega that's a 3x1 vector, and capital omega is the skew symmetric matrix. And then for rigid body motion, phi dot equals phi omega, it acts on the left. Now people act on the left because you want the inertial momentum to be independent of the position of the body. We're doing it this way, and we're doing right invariance of the Lagrangian. In classical mechanics, you would do left invariance of the Lagrangian with respect to an inertial operator. The inertial operator just tells you where the particles are relative to the angle of rotation. And we don't have I, we have this differential operator. This I is like a 3x3 matrix. Here, there's a differential operator. It's deformable. It tells you how particles interact. the integral here, because we're in vector fields, in rigid body mechanics, it would be trace, the usual Frobenius normal matrix trace. It would involve the inertial operator. And then the Hamiltonian, as we said, would be given by these equations. So that's the nice connection. And if we want to explore that connection in one or two more ideas, we could then evaluate this. We could look at what I've been talking about. So this is the Lagrangian for deformable shape, for diffeomorphic shape. It basically has this AVT is like the Eulerian momentum here. And now I'm going to relate it to the canonical or conjugate momentum. So if you look at the Hamiltonian, you would remove phi dot and you would get an equation for phi dot. And what phi dot looks like, and the way to think about, if you haven't done this recently, the way to think about p, just think about the p's as Lagrange multipliers. So you introduce these Lagrange multipliers called the canonical momentum to basically pin phi dot. You're going to remove phi dot at an extreme, on an extremal surface. And then the p's turn out to have very beautiful physical meaning, as Hamilton and many others have been doing for a long time now. So if you solve for this, you get phi dot is essentially the Green's kernel integrated against the canonical momentum. So what it tells us is that because we're in the deformable setting, the Green's kernel is wide, so the derivatives give you a wide Green's kernel. It basically says if you want to understand the vector field, it's an integral of a whole bunch of momenta of the particles. So even if the particle momenta, if they're each independent as they are in rigid body mechanics, for different objects, you then integrate them up to get a single vector field. So the vector field is the function of a lot of things, and the canonical momentum is sort of sitting on each of the particles. That means if you take that phi dot and you put it into the Hamiltonian, well, it always happens this way. You just take phi dot and you put it in here for phi dot, and you get a quadratic form in p and phi dot. So you get p kernel p, and this is the Hamiltonian. And then from the Hamiltonian, you can essentially get your force equation, which is the equation F equals ma that I was showing you before, corresponding to the conservation law. P dot is minus the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to phi. And in this case, here's the extra bunch of derivatives that we have that we don't have in rigid body mechanics, the Jacobian matrix. You have to take the Jacobian of the vector field, transpose, move it to phi, and then act on P. And this is essentially the geodesic equation. It says that now the canonical momentum is totally encoded in P0, and that's the power that we want to exploit. So that'll be the end of my talk about the connection. Let me just finish by saying the canonical momentum, PT, corresponds to the Eulerian momentum, AVT, by essentially you push AVT under phi, so to where the particles are, you push it, and then you have to do a change of density because phi is not rigid. Now I'm going to turn to anatomy and neuroinformatics. Do I have another 15 minutes? What time? I do. What time does the talk end? 11:40? Oh, good. I don't want to go to the end. I want to. We all get tired of each other after too long. I understand that. So now I'm going to turn to computational anatomy of populations and statistics on shape spaces. That'll be one topic, and then I'll finish with neuroinformatics. So I'm going to look now at an anatomical model of subcortical human anatomy in the brain, neuroanatomy. And Daniel Tward is a wonderful graduate student that I have that you guys traded us. I think, Daniel, you went to University of Toronto, and now he's at Hopkins, so we have to trade you a draft choice at some point. So anatomy at 1 millimeter scale is clumpy, and momentum is going to reduce it hugely. So diffeomorphic shape momentum provides a massive data reduction for morphometry because anatomy is clumpy. If the world is made not of independent particles of sands, but little objects, clumps, then this is why momentum is so valuable. It provides a massive data reduction for morphometry and helps with the curse of dimensionality. So I'll show that to you. So let's look at some subcortical anatomy. So here's a hippocampus. At 1 millimeter MR, we can't see inside of it. It's essentially a uniform blob. Here is the thalamus. Here's the, let's see, what is this? Globus pallidus, putamen. There are seven of these subcortical structures on the right side of your brain and seven on the left, and then ventricles. here's the ventricles. At 1 millimeter MR, we can't see inside of these. These are essentially uniform contrast, right? So think of them like billiard balls. They're deformable, but they're like billiard balls. So the conservation law is going to reduce us from a very high dimensional object to a very low dimensional representation. So here is the random field model that we're using for human anatomy. We'd like to be able to generate human anatomy, because if we could generate human anatomy, then we could calculate entropy, we could do estimation, we could do Bayes things, we could do everything that we all know how to do, but we want to, of course, do it on curved coordinate systems in human anatomy. So here's our random field model for the subcortical structures in the human brain. There's the amygdala, caudate, hippocampus, pallidus, putamen, thalamus, and ventricles. So the momentum, it's a singular object in this case. It's concentrated on the boundaries of these objects, because I told you that the geodesics, the conservation law says that if an object is blocky, it's all concentrated on the boundary. That's the equivalent of the reduction of velocities in rigid bodies to the center only associated with the angular momentum, one number. Now we end up with it on the boundary. Remember, it's normal to the level ones. That's a general property. Now the reason for that is because if you think about level lines, if you have a flow, there's a whole space of diffeomorphisms that move things along the level lines and don't change the contrast, don't change the image. Well, that's called the stabilizer of the group, and you want to remove the stabilizer. So essentially, the mathematics removes the stabilizer of the group for you. It tells you don't pay a penalty for motions that move tangent to the level line. So the momentum is concentrated on the surfaces of these structures. It's some unknown density, alpha, and there's a surface measure for each surface, so for the amygdala, caudate, hippocampus. And then the vector fields, of course, while these objects are all independent, the vector fields are all integrated together. So the covariance structure of the vector field is very interconnected, if you look at the covariance matrix, even if these are independent, and the kernel is the Green's kernel associated with the momentum, so it's like A inverse, and this is a 3x3 Green's matrix, and so this is how you get the vector fields, and then you flow the anatomy. So if I build a random densities on these surfaces, and then I integrate them against these kernels, then the objects I get are random configurations, anatomical configurations, and I can write down the probability law for that set of anatomical configurations. So for example, we have programs that under that probability law, you give me 500 or 1,000 anatomies, you stick 1,000 anatomies into it, we do shape mapping, we generate these flows, correspondences, and we solve an EM algorithm for estimating a configuration that's centered to the population that's in the middle, and then the covariance structure of the mappings that corresponds to that. So we can do real statistical inference. Now we have many different templates, and we're going to be talking about these templates, but the important point is statistics are all local in these curved coordinate systems. So statistics are all studied in atlas coordinates. So you index the population to the atlas. So when you have a random description, the random description comes with a density on the vector fields and the momentum that generates it and the atlas. Then if you have another atlas, that's a different local representation. And that's the sense in which local representations are local, okay, in these curved shape spaces. Now, we use principal component analysis and surface harmonics supported on the structures. The structures are curved, so we can't just use Fourier bases and wavelets. We have to do their generalization to curved coordinate systems. But all of that exists for representing structure and function on the curved anatomical coordinate systems in these templates. And as you all know, PCA, unlike surface harmonics are like the generalization of the Fourier bases to curved, smooth curved coordinate systems. Unlike surface harmonics, PCA requires training data. So if you're going to use PCA, you then have to have leave-out data. So if you're data-starved, we use surface harmonics, otherwise we use PCA. And in general, we basically reduce shape and structure to a function that's indexed over the coordinate systems, all pulled back to the template. So this is a basis on the template coordinate systems. And then there are some random variables that multiply them. And these become the random variables that we do inference in. So just to show you a picture of some surface harmonics, this is, I don't know, an amygdala or hippocampus or thalamus, and these are the first nine surface harmonics. You can look at them and they're sort of like the Fourier basis. The zeroth one is a constant, and then the first one is the first harmonic. And these are generalizations of spherical harmonics to these kinds of surfaces. And then here's another one. We can also, of course, do this for open surfaces with boundary conditions. And so you can see that the higher order harmonics are sort of giving you pluses and minuses. Now, why we want these pluses or minuses is the constant is going to represent like the uniform scale group, but the higher order ones are going to represent local change, and we want to see local change in anatomy. So we also use principal components. Of course, these require training data. Principal components tell you where the shapes are varying maximally. So for this shape, the third PCA component was very localized, and it's saying that you're moving about 2.5 millimeters. The first one was essentially a constant across the entire configuration, but they require training data. So now I'll show you representation of subcortical neuroanatomy on the aging population. So we have a population of 600 whole brain anatomies. These are published, part of the NIH, called the ADNI Project. A template atlas was generated. As I told you, we can write down the Bayesian model for generating anatomy, modeling anatomy in the orbit under these momenta flows. And then we estimated the template as an EM algorithm. Then we, with that template, we mapped the template onto every one of these anatomies, each with 14 target surfaces, and then we did principal component analysis on the momentum fields. Each momentum field is indexed to a different brain structure. We then studied the mappings. We're very interested in what's more complex, what's more variable. We did surface mapping constrained in the span of the basis as a function of dimension. We looked at the accuracy of the mappings as a function of dimension, and we examined shape, like a number like entropy, for example. So here's an example. So here's a hippocampus. If we do a lot of hard work and put about 12 dimensions into it, we can make our template, which represents the population, come pretty close to the target. So the target is gray, the template is red, I think, shown as a left target. No, target is red, it's a triangulated mesh, and the template is the gray mesh. And you can see that the gray mesh sort of goes through it at lots of places, because we've removed the rigid motion, we've put in scale, and we've adjusted the skew. So we've used all 12 degrees of freedom. And then I'll show you the mapping as a function of dimension. So that's after one dimension. The red and the gray should become closer to 10 dimensions, 15, 20, 25. Notice how you're seeing red and gray more on top of each other, 35, 40, 50, and so forth. And now we can collect that across 600, and we can ask, well, what do the eigenvalues of these dimensions look like? And basically we see that for amygdala, we need about 20 dimensions. Human anatomy in this population of aging and normals seems to be about 20 dimensional. This is the left and the right amygdala. This is the left and the right hippocampus. Notice how close they are. You know that structure across the symmetry plane is wildly inheritable. I don't think this is a coincidence. I think that's a beautiful, nice thing. Again, about 10 to 20 dimensions. And so then we can ask, how variable is human anatomy? And what we find is that thalamus is probably the most complex in terms of entropy or variation. Amygdala seems to be the simplest, and you move up like something like this. Okay, now let's use it. So I'm gonna now tell you about Huntington's disease. You can imagine that we now have methods for mapping onto populations. We can study structure in non-normal populations. So I'm gonna show you results in human from a large study across the country, and then I'm gonna show you mouse. So Huntington's disease, it's a fatal neurodegenerative disorder. There are no known treatments, terribly. And it's characterized by progressive brain atrophy, and we know it's in the striatal area. So here are these six favorite structures, not quite my favorite organs, but accumbens, caudate, putamen, thalamus, globus, and hippocampus. We mapped this template. We built a template from the population. We mapped it onto the three groups, far from onset, close to onset group, and early affected. These are categories that come from their genes. Basically, what we found was in the far from onset group, we found really, if you look here, it's really only in the globus structure. The globus seems to be the most sensitive in this sense. This is where statistically very strong change is occurring. As we move close to onset, we see that it's not only globus, but it spreads to the putamen. Again, these make up the striatum complex. And then it spreads to the caudate, and it comes down. This is all caudate, both sides of the caudate. Seems to also go back here a little bit in thalamus at early affected. So what's so exciting about this study is these are not subjects that we have at far from onset, close to onset, and early affected all simultaneously with three sets of scans. These are all elements of the population where we've moduloed out we've tried to modulo out these high dimensional nuisance variables and look for the discriminating dimensions in this diffeomorphism setting. So they're all contributing, and it's a very orderly motion. Now I'm going to show you, we also have this going in mouse models, and in mouse models, of course, we can devise treatments. We don't like the idea that this is fatal and there's no treatments. This is, you know, it's serious business. So the mouse models that are being used are certainly the R6-2 mouse. We essentially are looking for reliable biomarkers, and here we're in a longitudinal setting, so we really can look at the mouse at multiple times. So these are the measurements that we can make. We can make them at all different times during growth. We have both wild type and R6-2. Here's the untreated study. So if we look, this here is cortex, this is striatum, the three areas I was showing you, and then hippocampus is the last. We basically see that in wild type, there's no change in cortex in these momenta and Jacobian of these maps, whereas in these R6-2, there's a terrible early change for cortex, but then striatum happens, gray means when it really happens statistically, and then hippocampus is very late. We likely haven't looked at hippocampus in humans. That's why we're not seeing much in humans. And we also have a treated setup where we're looking at both sertraline and CoQ10, which look like they're going to be viable. And basically what red is untreated. And what green is, in this particular model for mouse, green is treated. And so we're really hopeful, of course. We haven't passed the bar. This is sertraline and CoQ10. We don't really see any difference between just sertraline treatment and both. We haven't passed the bar yet of this really becoming an adopted biomarker. We'll see. That's going to take more time. Okay, let me turn now to the last part of my presentation. I think I still have another minute or two. On neuroinformatics at 1 millimeter scale. I want to return to the Google problem. So I told you that we are essentially going to build registered coordinate systems and put information into those registered coordinate systems. I'd really like to have a company like Groupon. God, fastest growing company, I think, in the history of Wall Street. So let's look at what that means. Well, you can imagine if we have labeled atlases and there's information in labeled atlases, and we can take a brain and we can essentially push the coordinate systems of these label atlases accurately, then using things like material transport from mechanics, we can transport any information we have, points, curves, measures, densities, I mean, all those things we can transport. So we can then take a brain, which starts as a billion voxels or your favorite, whatever the size is, and we could bring it down to a list of numbers that maybe is 2,000 dimensions. And of course, this is what high throughput gene analysis did. And you know, that's a wonderful story. It would be great if imaging could get there. And so what we're doing now, of course, is trying to parlay this kind of detailed shape analysis I've been talking to about with other informatics like fMRI, like PET, like diffusion-weighted images, all the other imaging modalities that we can do routinely in high throughput and end up with discriminating dimensions. Now, we not only have these atlases, but we have individuals regressed against these atlases. So here's an example of a regression. So in some response variable, I don't know, there's 2,000 of these numbers. Pick a number, let's say 3. Maybe 3 corresponds to the hippocampus, and we'll have diffusion-weighted imaging on it, so we'll have fractional anisotropy, we'll have surface area, we'll have volume, we'll have fMRI response, and so forth. In some response measure, we have a series of patients that we've regressed in time, and we've made measurements in that response measure, so each subject gives a feature vector, a large feature vector, 2,000 dimensions, and for each feature in the feature vector, we have normals, and we have as controls, and then we have various age populations. And so for this feature vector, what we see is if we go to age 5, we see that this is the normal category in here for the response variable. This is 1 standard deviation, this is 2 standard deviations, and this is 3 standard deviations. So we can use that. So for example, we can take a brain for subject 1, get a long feature vector, and annotate all of the 3 standard deviation values, and then do clustering. Do your favorite clustering. Support vector machines, LDA, pick your favorite clustering. But we've gone from a billion numbers to 2,000 discriminating dimensions. That's the idea. So we can take a semantic dementia case, and we can ask, how do the semantic dementias change versus normals in this big space, right? So we started with a billion voxels. We're now down at 1,000 or 2,000 dimensions. We start with a basis that maybe comes from PCA, and then we add loading, so we do linear discriminant analysis. And so we can start putting different individuals, like semantic dementia people, into this space, and we can ask, where is the discriminating plane from the normals? So, and when you ask, well, what is the discriminating vector sitting on? What's a PCA vector sitting on? Well, it's sitting on all the anatomical regions if you look at its support. So it turns out that for semantic dementia, there seems to be involvement in the putamen, inferior temporal lobule, the uncinate, and so forth. So that's the idea of what we would like to be able to do. We also are trying to use this for retrieval, of course. You know that radiologists have always trained with dossiers. You know, lung cancers, there's going to be 20 famous cases that are at every major radiology center that the residents train on. You know, the 20 versions of lung cancer, that this is what this looks like, right? So we'd like to be able to take a measurement and put it into cloud brain space and bring back all of the anatomies, all the configurations that are close in this 2,000 dimensional feature space and look at them. So for example, here are some examples. So you put in, this happened to be a certain kind of dyskinesia, which involves the temporal lobe. You put in an individual and you say, well, this is over here. What comes back as being close? What do these points look like? Does it look similar in the area where we're seeing the discriminating dimensions? So we're in the process now of essentially doing retrieval in this way and markup. So we have at Hopkins now, the pediatric pipeline is all going through this analysis, and we have about 28 named diseases in the ontology, and we have 2 radiologists who are marking these up, and we're trying to see if we can essentially do, we can build a machine that can really assist us in delivering information like this to help in radiological practice. So let me finish on that note. Thank you.